word we haven't used is communism, right? Do you want to facilitate organization into chit-chat, or how should we? So I think we can break out into smaller groups and just chat for 20 minutes. That's the freedom and the instruction that we have. So. Yes, please.
You mentioned it's hard to conceptualize anti-capitalism. Mm-hmm. What is your take?
What are your takes? I mean, I don't know. I find it very hard to think about anti-capitalism, which is not to say that it's impossible. I just find it very difficult to think about it.
If may I?
Please, yeah. And
you might be familiar with the cybernetic hypothesis, that the cybernetics is the dominant story we tell about ourselves today, and how it actually suits the capitalism. Mm-hmm. And this idea that that the words or the concept that are akin to cybernetics, meaning the effectivity of the system, the productivity, and so on. I'd like to notice how we so intuitively adopted these words of productivity, effectivity, and even if when we are talking about spirituality, of the care of oneself, we usually have this experience of people talking about the goal of all these high-spirited endeavors, that I can become more productive in this way.
That's right.
I can be more effective. Couldn't this be one of the roots of anti-capitalism? Be self-reflective about the easiness of adopting these somewhat tainted concepts, machinic behavior.
Yeah. I mean, I'm wondering if other people might want to jump in on that or other things rather than it go through me, perhaps. Could you tell me your name and then we have more. Paul, yeah. I mean, I think just, you know, to throw that open, I think you're probably right in that what you're suggesting is that there are epistemic milieus that structure the way in which we know how to think about a structure or a system, and the post-World War II history of cybernetics is very important to that, for sure. And so what would it mean then to come up with other ways to know our condition might be something that you're asking?
Maybe we could ask ourselves, should we want to be productive? Should we want to be effective? I'm not sure. I mean, to a certain extent, certainly. I mean, everyone has some kind of ambitions, life goals. Even if it's as ambiguous as making one's life meaningful, and that we must be productive in order to reach this goal, must be effective in reaching this goal. Maybe in the process we lose the tie with the value that comes from being lost, and to not know what one should do. to maintain this position of being lost at some point.
Can I pick up on one word that you've said and maybe throw that out and wonder what people want to do with it, which is the question want, right? Because this question want is a question of desire, right? And I think one of the things that you're throwing up here is what is the place of desire in relation to these economies? And here I'm thinking with Lauren Berlant, who has this idea of a desire for a life, and how a desire for a life often exceeds the scripts that we are given to live by, right? And one of the difficult things here is that the script that capital gives us is a dynamic upon which the reproduction of our own lives depends, right? So I might want to be not productive. I mean, my students are facing this all the time, right? They might want to be not productive, but the condition of possibility for them to have a livable future depends upon them not just being productive, but being productive through a script that is given to them, right? And then how does one deal with that? This is the problem of structure, right? Structure is not something that is determining and that predetermines, but structure is something that constrains desires. And it means that living one's desire comes with cost, right? And then what do we do? And then what do we do as a matter of politics, I think, becomes a really difficult question.
But if you stray from that script, there's going to be some punishment, or you're going to be excluded, or you're going to be suffer some consequences if you die, in one way or the other. Mm-hmm. Those risks, people are going to weigh it, and at the end, they may stray a little bit, but they go back into the flow. Mm-hmm.
Have any of you read the work of the anthropologist Johnny Steinberg? He's a South African anthropologist, and he's written this most extraordinary paper. It's a book, but there's a paper version of it in Public Culture speaking about this, and I'm picking up on your word risk, right? And the book is called The Man of Good Hope, and the article in Public Culture is called The Vertiginous Power of Decisions. For me, it was a mind-blowing article. So basically, what Steinberg, the project for Steinberg, is to follow the life history of a forced migrant, a forced Somali migrant, right? And he's thinking about this question of forced migration. And of course, the discourse of forced migration that we have is that in some ways, this is one of the most abject conditions, right? That people have no choice, that this is in fact a complete absence of freedom. And he's tracing the life story of Asad, this migrant, who makes a whole series of decisions that in fact make no sense because he wants to end up in America. So he leaves Mogadishu with his wife, he goes to Kinshasa, does all of these really dangerous, precarious forms of work. That's not enough for him. He wants to end up in Johannesburg. His wife says, you know, this is too much for me. We can't live like this. We don't know what the next day will bring. Let us at least go back home. So he leaves his wife, sends her back to Mogadishu. So there's a breaking of familial ties here, and keeps going to Johannesburg and takes all of these. So he makes all of these decisions that are absolutely senseless, right? And then ends up in these really dangerous situations in Johannesburg as a way to eventually end up in the US. The question that Steinberg asks at the end is, why is that not freedom? In that the sort of calculus with which we think in our non-forced migratory lives, in which we think of a sensible decision, is completely bound up with actuarial logic. It's completely bound up with risk. It's completely bound up with what a secure future will look like, right? That is tied into wage labor relationships, structures of social security, the way in which a future we will be cared for in a future when we cannot work, such that anything else is completely senseless. And what he's saying is, but because of this situation of forced migration, Assad is actually making, and these are not innocent decisions, right? They're violent decisions. They're violent to his family, they're violent to himself. But he's making a series of decisions that we, in our neoliberalized actuarial lives, cannot conceptualize making, even if we claim that we have desire, quote unquote. Right. And that's so interesting.
In, what you're saying is very similar to a case in Honduras, like people fleeing Honduras in thousands of caravans. And I've known people, I've heard testimonies, and they're doing this act that is completely irrational but rational at the same time.
Yes.
They're suffering a lot in the process, but they're just straying away for a moment.
That's right.
Fleeing something, but they're going to get back into another system that might as well explode them in other ways.
Yes.
But they have certain commodities or certain benefits that they will not receive in Honduras, for example, but maybe in the United States they will receive maybe health.
Yes.
A little bit better.
Yes.
But the children are being put in cages. I don't know, it's very difficult because flee a little bit and
but also see how the pro-immigration discourse in the US can only frame these people as victims. Right? So the pro-immigration discourse has no space for any notion of radical agency or freedom on the part of the migrant who is fleeing violence. So there's something about the discursive structure of this and what it does not allow us to imagine, which goes back to your point about how we are taught to know a situation. That's very interesting. Yeah.
Like you mentioned, legislation could maybe bring in something, a difference of shifting maybe desires, perspectives. Do you think, for instance, that they bring in new actors now in legislation, new subjects, making a river a legal subject, does this irritate this capitalistic system? Is there some potential for irritation in doing such things?
Yeah, I think so. And I really like the word irritation. I mean, the thing that I've become very pessimistic about is that anything can overthrow capital that easily. But I think that there are lots of things that can perturb and irritate and constrain and slow it down and create friction. And those open up spaces for politics. Right? They may or may not open up spaces for revolution or structural transformation, but they certainly open up spaces for politics, I think. And that's where, you know, something like law becomes so interesting because it opens up a space for politics.
Because you work a lot about pharmaceuticals, is on this field, which is then, which gives us not anymore any distance to think if these substances of capitalism are in each cell of our bodies.
Yeah.
How to think there, the shift is already, it's in each molecule.
Yeah, that's the terrifying thing, isn't it? Yes, yeah.
Are you that related to a certain, kind of a perception on life, and then now the knowledge of life, about life is totally abstract?
That's right.
That also associated with this, let's see, the kind of abstract financial.
That's right.
You don't have any, you are not able to somehow, you know, to individually.
That's right.
Your experiences actually doesn't
really
help.
That's right.
To understand what's going on.
That's right.
And then, I think that also goes to a very important, you were doing lots of research on this medical economy,
this is the, I mean, is really the daily urgency for many of the people.
That's right.
Not about save the life. Actually, it's about how this life could be perceived as something that can be part of your
yes.
care.
Yeah, yeah.
And this is for me the extremely interesting because in China, you know, the Chinese medical treatment, mm-hmm. in a way, is not trying to scientifically, you know, give kind of
yes.
Semi, how to say, objective, like analyze of what's your problem.
Mm-hmm.
And then the technique is very much somehow related to your body capacity.
That's right.
And less of depending right. on the professional like technique,
that's right.
where that you create this kind of depending or rely on the system.
So that's right.
I don't know whether this also connects to what you are concerned, because I think it's not only the kind of, you know, perceptionally that we feel, but also I think, you know, like regarding the way that how we learn life,
yes. Yes.
there is lacking of these practices where that you can really, you know, somehow, I don't know, you know, everything becomes abstract.
That's right.
So,
that's right.
I don't know whether this,
you know, this is so important, and just some loud thinking with this, right? Because one of the inherent violences in a commodification process that leads to valorization is abstraction, right? Such that tangible social relations, tangible relationships to one's own subjectivity become abstracted, because the abstraction is essential for fungibility and circulation, right? So that, you know, your health has to in some ways be possible to render in the same terms as your water bottle, such that they can both move in ways that creates capital for the capitalist, right? And so abstraction is very important. And I wonder, as a sort of speculative throwback, is in relation to biocapital, is whether this might be a place to think about the politics of use value, right? Because one of the things that Marx says is that for capital, use value has no meaning, right? The commodification process is all about exchange value. Value is created from exchange. And in the sort of pharmaceutical economies that I'm part of, you know, the Indian generic industry critiquing multinational pharmaceutical companies, right? It's a critique of the capital of biocapital. As in, the way in which you're doing it makes drugs too expensive, makes people take too many drugs, doesn't allow other people to have drugs. And it's an argument of industrial capital with financial capital, right? Big pharma is very financialized. The Indian industry, for instance, is not. And so you get all of these. And this is what I was thinking of when I was talking about struggles between capitalisms. But Jean-Paul Gaudelier, who's a historian of medicine in Paris, has been studying Ayurveda. And he says that the critique that Ayurveda makes of pharma is the critique of the bio of biocapital, which is that actually your drugs don't make people better. You know, and that how do we think about other forms of health care, right, that might address bodily conditions in more holistic ways, and so on. And this then opens up this question of what does it mean in relation to the way in which capital structures our modes of knowing, if we insist upon use value economies and the valuing of use value in ways that potentially interrupt a discourse that is set up entirely in terms of exchange value, precisely because of the potential for abstraction that resides in the commodification process of exchange, right? Yeah.